and my notes are gone. Where are they? Welcome.
Same place as mine. Sorry.
We're off for a good start.
Moot Talks. A podcast by Moot Markarai. With your host, Ira Molai.
Welcome to today's edition of Moot Talks. Today's guest, who I'm very happy to talk to, is a biologist by training, a graduate, biology graduate. She used to be active in the sales of scientific equipment. Is now very busy as an amateur astronomer, presenter, and writer, and is a bass player as well. But I must honestly say, I don't really know where to start, because what I've just told you is just a tiny glimpse of what my guest does, and doesn't really describe her well. Every topic that you touch is like a rabbit hole that you dive into, because there's so much more to follow and so much more that she does. So without further ado, let me very, very warmly welcome Mary McIntyre. Hello, Mary.
Hi.
It's so great to have you on today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So since it's so difficult where to start, because there is so much, maybe we should, touch on the topic of how and where we met and what, the first thing that connects us. I don't know, maybe I give the floor to you and you just talk about that a little.
We met because of Iridium satellite flares. Sadly have gone now, but it was just such a great thing to be in. Sorry, my cat. also lover of cats. We met through Iridium flare photography and sharing photographs of Iridium flares, and a project that was put together to try and catch photographs of all of the satellite that flared before the whole network was deorbited. And that kind of brought together a real niche community within the astronomy world, and you was one of those people. And it was really nice to connect with people that had a love of those things, because I know they were a bit of a love-hate thing, but not many people kind of kept spreadsheets and records of all the Iridium flares that they captured, and that was one thing we all did, which I thought was a great connection.
Yes, I guess it immediately sort of got us close, because we shared the same passion for that, which it's a sad thing, because it's over now. So
I know.
We have to rely on our records and all the beautiful pictures that we've taken. So I guess this brings me to the first point. When we talk about Iridium flares, it has to do with the night sky. So what I mainly do there is look up and think, well, this is wonderful and marvelous, and take out my smartphone to take some pictures, and that's just about it. Yeah. But with you, it's a whole different order of magnitude. So you say you're an amateur astronomer, but you have got yourself some training, if I understand that correctly. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I've loved the night sky since I was a child. My mum loved the moon because she remembers seeing the moon landings when she was a child, and I kind of got my passion of the night sky from her. And before I could even read properly, I was looking at star maps and the mythology of stars, the Ladybird books about the constellations and the Greek myths, and that really captured me. But as an adult, once you start working, it's quite a difficult hobby to maintain practically, because you can't stay up till 5 in the morning if you've got to get up for work the next day. So it sort of took a back burner. It was always an interest, and then I moved to London when I was 18, and you can't see an awful lot from London. There's a lot of light pollution. So I remember seeing Comet Hale-Bopp, and I kind of always wanted another telescope. I had one when I was 11. It was a bit rubbish, didn't really know what to do with it, didn't really have a mentor, but that interest was always there. But when I became disabled and couldn't work anymore, I had the opportunity of doing the astronomy GCSE, and that just really reignited it. I mean, I was already using my telescope again, but that got me into trying astrophotography. And it just went on from there. Once I started to learn, I thought I knew a lot about astronomy till I studied the GCSE and realised I knew nothing and I wanted to know more. So I went on and studied with the Open University and did the certificate in astronomy and planetary science, which again was next level of information. But while all that was happening, I was carrying on with the astrophotography, getting better at that, getting better equipment. Through astronomy, I met my husband and he built us an observatory. And so we kind of took everything to the next level there. And then off the back of that, I now do a lot of astronomy talks and astrophotography workshops. And I do talks from age 2 to 100. So I'm kind of covering lots of different topics all to do with astronomy, lots of different places around the country. And so, yeah, it's been amazing. Actually, sometimes I'm so busy writing talks and I write some articles for Sky at Night that I don't actually have time to do any practical astronomy. So I've got so busy with astronomy, I can't do astronomy sometimes, which is a bit frustrating. But, you know, equally, I love getting a magazine article that might be something that's slightly outside of my comfort zone and makes me carry on learning, which is, you know, what we're always doing in this hobby. So I keep very busy kind of within the community. And
So I'm not really fearing that you will get out of practice soon, because I very often see your astronomy pictures on the social media, so I guess you're well in practice.
Yeah, but not as many pictures as I'd like, but I, you know, I've managed to fill up another hard drive in the last 12 months, so I'm doing something.
So, and I guess you've also started a couple of things. You know, you're very motivated to showcase what women do in science and in astronomy as well. Is that right? Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, definitely. A few years ago, some friends of mine were running the Knowledge Observatory in the north of England. And what they were doing there is taking children or teenagers from slightly deprived backgrounds or people that didn't have the best time at school, and they were using astronomy as a vehicle for teaching core subjects. And it was a really great thing that they were doing, and they realized that there was a huge disparity professionally in senior roles of women in astronomy. And certainly there was still a disparity back then as well within hobby astronomers. There are certain women that don't feel comfortable going to a star party by themselves, for example, that they're just worried about being out in a field in the dark with a load of men, which is crazy. And they set up the UK Women in Astronomy Network as a way of trying to bring positive female role models, both amateur and professional, to encourage amateur astronomers to keep going with their hobby, but also to try and encourage young girls into a career in astronomy and space science, and to show them that there's a whole world of careers out there within STEM subjects. And I took over the running of that a few years ago, and it's primarily social media based, but if there's ever a story of something interesting that's been done by a female astronaut or a female speaker or anything, whether they're an amateur or whether they're a professional, we try and share those stories on there. But we also showcase anyone that we've got a Flickr group for female astrophotographers, so that other women can go and get inspiration from what those women are doing. But we share stuff that's relevant to male and female. We're not kind of an exclusively female social media. There are male followers there as well who are interested in helping spread the word of what women do in the hobby and professionally. But also there's information that's relevant whether you're a male or a female. It's just about astronomy as well. So it's not one of these kind of, oh, no men allowed kind of platforms. We do have males as well. And they've been instrumental in helping get the word out, which, you know, I know a lot of men that are very passionate about promoting women and not just astronomy, but computer science and physics and that kind of thing as well. So it's been really nice to kind of be involved with that and just try and help people as much as possible. And I do so much on a one-to-one with people. I mean, just this week, there was a lady contacted me on Twitter. Her daughter's doing astronomy GCSE and had borrowed a camera, didn't have a clue where to start. So I've been exchanging messages. And then yesterday I got a photograph sent that she'd taken with this camera, which is amazing. Some lovely star trails. And she, you know, she's done that because of help that I've given. And I hope that encourages her to do the same. So I really love that when I help people and they send me pictures that they've taken because they've followed my advice or pointers, and that makes it all worthwhile. So yeah, there's a lot of women out there doing really good work that don't promote themselves enough, so it's good to have a platform to do that.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's one of your many, many talents, you know, to put into a nutshell what people are good at and what they do, and just put it out there. So what's your experience when you're out there, you know, doing talks and all that? So how interested are girls or women in astronomy or science topics on the whole?
Very, actually. At a younger age, the girls are as into it as the men are. There's just something happens when girls reach teenage years. I don't know whether they lose confidence in their abilities. I'm not really sure what it is, but I'm always astounded when I go and do a talk at an astronomy society and I find out I'm only the second female speaker they've had in a 50-year history. And it just astonishes me because I guess because of what I do, I've connected with a lot of females who are interested in astronomy. I don't know why these people aren't being booked also to do talks. I don't know whether they're just not confident enough to promote themselves to do it. I really don't know. I don't feel that I'm extra talented in any way. I've been lucky enough that word of mouth has spread and I'm really busy with talks. But it makes me sad that, you know, if people are possibly using me as the poster female speaker, hopefully the repeat bookings I get are not because of that, they're because they enjoy my talks. But I hope it makes people think that there are other women out there doing it, because there are loads of women that do talks in astronomy and space science and physics, but people just don't know the names of them. And I don't know. Girls are as interested as boys are at school. I don't know what happens between then and adulthood that's making them not pursue this more seriously. I wish I knew the answer to fix this, because you know, there is still a big disparity at senior level with women working in STEM. And it's the same in music. It's the same in computer programming. There's a lot of women doing it at a younger age. There's loads of girls go on workshops to learn, but not that many computer programmers at a senior level. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I really don't understand why. I mean, over the years, there's been a lot of overt sexism out there. And there are certain people that still think that women aren't capable of doing this kind of mental stimulation, which is quite shocking. I think women are so good at multitasking, and they're so good at, you quite often get men, and this is a very sweeping statement, but men are very often good at one thing particularly. Mm-hmm. And they're okay at other things, but a lot of women I know are brilliant at so many things, and they seem to be multi-talented and still manage to do that while juggling motherhood and school runs and all of this type of thing. And I just think that needs to be celebrated more. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, women are good at this stuff. If that's where their passion is, they're very good at this stuff, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be doing astronomy, physics, astronauts, you know, whatever.
So any ideas what kind of encouragement would be most valuable to girls or teenagers to pursue a career?
I think just constantly, if you have a social media presence yourself, just sharing stories of other women that are doing it, showing them that there are role models out there. I mean, very often if you say to any, just a general group of people, name a famous female astronomer, they could probably name Caroline Herschel, possibly a couple of others. But I do a talk on women in astronomy, and in an hour I can fill the time just people before Caroline Herschel. There isn't even time to talk about the people after her. So we need to get the word out more about the important role that women have played previously in history, because there's a lot of women that did Now, women had to go through hoops to be able to get jobs in astronomy in the kind of 19th century. They had to be way overqualified compared to the men. They were paid far less. And then if they got married, they usually had to give up their work. And despite that, they were still doing it. You know, these were the women that just thought, no, we're going to break the mold here and just get out and do that. And so on UK Women in Astronomy, we have Brian Jones, who's an astronomy historian, and he's constantly sharing stories about women astronomers from all the way through history. He'll share their birthdays or the anniversary of a crater being named after them, things like that. So that's really good to show that actually there was a lot going on before Caroline Herschel, as amazing as she was, and I would love to go back and meet her. There's a lot of stuff that's gone on before that, and equally there are a lot of people in the future that are the rising stars, and I follow them on social media, follow their stories, the people that are getting out there and showing what they're doing, because that will give confidence to younger generations to go and do the same. So I think just more of that, and if we see anybody being outwardly sexist, just stamp on it straight away, because it's not okay to be like that in this day and age.
So I guess by now our audience might have found out why I talked about the rabbit hole at the beginning. So everything that you've said just now would be a topic in itself, you know, which we could talk about for maybe even more than an hour or so. But you've given me some, you know, keywords already about the many talents that so many women have, and I just sort of have to pass this back to you. Move on to one of your other passions and talents. So you're also a bass player, and that's also something that unites us.
Yes.
I would always be far too scared to call myself a bass player, because my level of doing it is incredibly limited, but I have a great passion for it. So what do you do as a bass player, and how did you get there, and how does it fit together with everything else, if it does?
I was born in 1973, so as a child, my early memories is disco music, which is cheesy and pretty terrible when you listen to it these days. But there's one thing that runs through disco music, and that is amazing bass lines. And those guys really knew how to funk some bass, and I was tuned into that before I even knew what bass was. I became a dancer when I was a teenager. I used to do lots of different styles of dance, like ballroom, Latin, and rock and roll, disco. And the disco is the stuff like Earth, Wind and Fire, dancing to that stuff, and you're really locked into the bass whether you know it or not. When you're dancing, that's what you're dancing to. So I've always had that kind of rhythm, but I never felt I had the coordination to be a drummer. I can't do things independently with four limbs. I just can't do it. But when I was 16, I got with my first boyfriend, who was a guitar player, and I knew I could never match up to what he could do on guitar. So it kind of fell in that I would buy a bass and learn. And to be honest, it's the only instrument I've really ever wanted to learn anyway. So I was probably about 21 when I bought my first bass, which I still have. I will always have a very sentimental attachment to it. It's, I guess, by today's standard, it'd be a bass-shaped object. It's not really gig-worthy, but I will always love it. So I kind of played in my bedroom. I had lessons, but again, this confidence thing, I was too scared to join a band. I didn't think I'd be good enough. I was scared of making a mess. My teacher said, you need to join a band. And I was just, no, not ever happening. There's only three people had ever heard me play. And that kind of took a back burner. And about 4 years ago, it'll be, I was having lessons again in the village I live in now. And my bass teacher kept saying to me, you need to join a band. And I was like, no, I'm not joining a band. And in my lesson, I was learning Hotel California, and I'd only just started playing it. And he said to me, oh, I my friend next door's just learned this, I'll give him a call. And he brought him in and said, right, let's play it together. And I was like, oh, there's somebody else in the room, I can't do this. And he just threw it on me, because he knew I would say no if he asked. And I kind of did it and thought, okay, I went wrong a couple of times, it wasn't too bad. And then after another lesson, when he did the same, the guitar player said, oh, actually, I'm in a band who's looking for a bass player. Come down and play with us. So I kind of was, okay, this was an audition without me even knowing I was being auditioned for the role as this bass player. So I kind of went down, and it was in at the deep end. Whatever you think you know about music, you don't know anything until you join a band. And within 6 months, I understood why my teachers kept telling me you need to join a band. This band, the first band I joined is a guy who writes really beautiful folk-inspired music. It was all original material, so I had to write my own bass lines for the first time ever. I had to learn where the notes were on my fretboard for the first time ever. I had to understand what I could play over a chord for the first time ever. So it wasn't just suddenly learning a song anymore. It was about understanding composition, and I just threw myself into it and absolutely loved it. The first time we played an open mic night, I was almost sick with nerves because I was so frightened of playing in public. And I guess it took a year of severe stage fright before I started to actually enjoy it. And at the same, around about a month after I joined that band, another band with the same guitar player asked me if I'd come and jam with them as well. So I ended up in two bands. I never do anything by halves. So I joined two bands, and suddenly I was kind of doing open mic nights and gigging with two bands. And again, it took probably 18 months of regular gigging before I got over this abject terror of being on stage. What really broke the stage fright for me was my band was due to host an open mic night, and the guitar player cut his finger really badly, and he said, oh, I'm going to have to cancel. But it was near Christmas, and I knew there were loads of people in the village were looking forward to it. Contacted another singer. Can you step in? No, I've got laryngitis. So I had 48 hours. I thought, right, I'm going to have to step up and do this. So I had to learn lead vocals to 8 songs in 48 hours. Wow. And then get up and perform lead vocals and play bass at this open mic night. I didn't enjoy a second of it. I hated being on lead vocalist. I really hated it. But after that night, there is nothing now that scares me about performing, because it was just, it was, I didn't have enough time to talk myself out of it. So I'm kind of glad I did it, but I never ever want to be a lead vocalist again. I just really didn't enjoy the experience. But since then, now when I get up and play bass, I just enjoy it, and I'm not bothered if I go wrong. I just want to look like we're having a good time. And a new band that I started playing with recently, we play really upbeat songs that everyone knows and sings along to. And so I've got a nice mixture now of stuff that's our own composition, stuff that's covers, and a real mixture with the three different bands that I've been involved with. So yeah, my bass skill has definitely improved massively since joining those bands. And you know, now learning a new song can take me 2 hours, where it used to take me a month. So you pick things up a lot quicker, and my technique has definitely improved, although I've got a long way to go, I think. But I do really enjoy it, and if I haven't been playing for a while, I just kind of feel a bit like, oh, I need the music. I think music's very healing, isn't it? It can be a good experience. So
absolutely, I feel exactly the same. You know, I miss it when I don't do it for a long time, and yeah. There are those, it always happens late in the evening, where I think I have to play some bass now.
Yeah.
And of course I have to put the volume down and everything, you know, but then I just put on some music that I like and try to play along, and it's, I don't know, afterwards I'm sure, it feels so good. So it is.
It's good. And the stuff I listen to generally is not necessarily what I play with the bands. Yeah. But I like the fact that, and I would never have contemplated learning a Bruno Mars song, but actually there are a couple of Bruno Mars songs that are incredibly fun to play on bass, and that would just not have even been on my radar. And I'm getting to play pop punk, I'm getting to play classic rock, I'm getting to play some kind of Dusty Springfield type stuff. And it's just such a wide variety of music, and it's really good to just get those different styles learned, because you can't just be, well, you can just be a rock bassist, but I like to branch out and learn different styles. So having the folk and the rock and punk and just all these different inspirations, it's just really good fun to learn the different techniques. And you know, the YouTube's great as well. If there's a particular style you want to try and mimic, there are so many great YouTube tutorials out there, which, you know, lose me within about 30 seconds, but you know, you kind of pick up the basics.
And there we go into another rabbit hole, and we could talk about this for hours. There's another thing, Mary, that I would like to address. I started off introducing you as a biologist and someone who sold scientific equipment. So what happened to this science career? We have not talked about that yet. Has this been lost in the past? And if so, why?
Yeah, well, what happened when I was working in a research lab in the 90s, I was only 21. I was doing my degree part time at the time. I injured my back moving compressed gas cylinders, and I ended up having a lot of time off that year, and my back never really fully recovered from that. I always had a weakness there. When I was selling scientific equipment, I was loading heavy equipment into the car, and I felt my back go again, but that time I had to have surgery. So I've now had 5 surgeries on my spine. I spent a lot of years in a wheelchair, so it kind of put an end to the driving and an end to my career. So I just had to turn it into a positive and just thought, right, it's great, this gives me more time for astronomy. I had to have something to keep my brain going. So I still have a lot of spinal problems. I have a lot of pain issues. I've got hardware in my spine that tells me when it's going to rain because my screws ache. It's just crazy. It's kind of this internal barometer there. So if I've been busy doing talks or I've had a night out in the cold doing astrophotography, I know for a couple of days I'm going to be bedridden. If I have a busy week doing a lot of talks, the chances are I'll be bedridden for several days afterwards. But I'm strongly of the mind that I'd rather have those big positive days and then take the consequences and actually enjoy doing the talks and getting that mental stimulation. So I know some people think I'm crazy, but I always push too hard. And one of the side effects of, unfortunately, my condition is the pain causes me to have non-epileptic seizures. And it drives my husband mad because if I'm having seizures, it means I've done too much. And you know me well enough to know that that happens on an almost weekly basis. So I've kind of got a bit better in the last year of listening to my body more. And if it's too much, I just think, no, tonight I'm not going to go out imaging. I'm going to listen to my body and rest. But I really do a lot of craft activities as well. And even on the days where I'm in bed, I'm not sitting idle. I'm crocheting or knitting or painting or jewelry making or whatever it is I feel capable of doing on a tray in bed. That's what I'll do. So I never actually ever do nothing. I just can't. I'm now so stubbornly determined to not let this condition beat me that no matter what stage of pain I'm in, I'll crochet lead flat on my back if necessary, but I'll still be making something. So
I guess that's an incredibly amazing thing. Touches me so much about you, and what I admire so much about you is this incredible, on the one hand, this multi-talented facet of you, and on the other hand, this adaptability. Yeah? So how you deal with those challenges and how you sort of only bring them up in, I don't know, a part of a sentence, or if asked about it, as if this was a minor thing. And by what you've described about your condition, I get that at least there are days where it's not at all a minor thing, yeah, but where it has a really...
No, it's... Well, when I first got into astronomy kind of within social media, everybody knew that I was the disabled lady that was into astronomy. And then about 4 years ago, I was given, I have a spinal cord stimulator, so it's kind of wired up. There's electrodes near my spinal cord, and I've got a battery under the skin in the side, and it behaves a bit like a TENS machine. And I'd had one previously that didn't work, and I was offered the surgery of this next generation one that worked at a different frequency. And I went in there with a completely open mind, not expecting anything. And they switched it on, and even before it was optimized, probably within 8 hours, I started to walk around the ward without crutches. And I went in there in a wheelchair. I could only walk 30 meters at most. By the end of the 8-day trial, I was walking the length of the ward with no crutches at all. So they were like, okay, that's a good sign. I got the surgery. And there are still days when I can't walk more than 10 meters, but for the most part, with sticks, I can get around and do things now. And that kind of gave me back a lease of life. And I think I felt like it was a second chance. I'd kind of got in a bit of a rut where I did a few craft things. I had a passing interest in astronomy. I'd done the studying, but didn't really have that light in me. And I kind of felt, right, this is a second chance. This could go at any time. My back could go again. This could stop working and I'd be back to square one. I'm going to make the most of every single day that I've got that's better and use every second of time that I have to the best of my ability. And by having that mentality, I probably give myself more down days than if I didn't, ironically. But I just kind of, now people know me as the amateur astronomer that does talks, and it's only as a passing thing they think, oh, actually, it says on her website that she might need wheelchair access sometimes. And it's a surprise. People just don't know that. And I guess, you know, I've had disability hate messages on social media. I've had prejudice. I've had bad experiences. And I have had just outright abuse if I talk about my seizures or whatever from certain people. So I tend to guard some of that now on my social media outlets, because generally people don't want to hear about your bad day. I if it's a really bad day, I'll have a moan. But in general, I just put a positive spin on it, because people aren't interested. They don't want to hear about you having a crap day. They don't want to hear about you're not being able to walk this time. So I tend to not talk about it as much on social media. And it's not because I'm ashamed of it or anything. It's just because I can't cope with the abusive messages afterwards. It's just so soul destroying when you do so much for the community and give your time freely for so many things, and all people can do is say, oh, you're just looking for attention if you moan about this thing. And so I don't have the energy, so it's easier to just compartmentalize that. And people who know me well can tell when I'm having a bad day. They can tell without me saying. They can tell reading between the lines of what I write on my statuses. They know. So that's really nice that there are people out there that look out for me. But in general, you know, I'm actually having a bad phase again at the moment where I'm losing mobility, but it's not as bad as it was before the surgery. So I'm just kind of pulling back a little bit from all the traveling and hoping that things settle again. But if that's it and I have to stop doing talks, it's been an amazing 4 years and I'm glad that I did it. So fingers crossed it won't come to that. But, you know, I just, that gave me my second lease of life. And, you know, I now am so motivated to just make the best of, even if things do go horribly wrong and I end up kind of almost wheelchair bound again, I'm never going to go back to the place I was before, because there's too many things that have been re-sparked in my head, and I'll just keep fighting and keep going.
I'm sure you will. What I'd be interested in now is, obviously there was a time when you were in a very bad place. So what helped you to get out of it and to become or stay optimistic and positive? How did you do that? What resources did you use?
Initially, when things were really bad, I found a chronic pain forum. I found two chronic pain forums, and it was really good connecting with other people that have gone through the same thing, particularly because I was at a relatively young age. And I've already noticed since my first injury, the way doctors treat me now, I'm 47, is very different from how they did when I was 21. And now it's very much, oh, well, you're just getting older. They're not as keen to help as they were then. So I've noticed a bit of a shift from the medical profession. But having other people that were younger that had gone through it, kind of sharing things that work, that didn't work. I've tried every fad diet. I've tried every exercise regime, graded exercise regime. I suffer with fibromyalgia as well as all the other medical things. And one of the things you get with that is chronic fatigue. And when you have chronic fatigue, graded exercise just does not work. They constantly tell you it does, but every time I've tried it and stuck with it, I've ended up in A&E. It's just not worth it. So I have stretches that I do regularly that help the pain. I kind of do a certain amount of core stability stuff, adapted Pilates, and I do that regularly. I do try and walk a little bit. Certainly I'm active around the house, even if I don't go out walking. So I kind of keep the activity levels like that. Otherwise, it's been mindfulness has been a really big help. And I think I was very I didn't understand mindfulness at all when I did the first mindfulness course. We're kind of staring at this raisin for 20 minutes and I'm kind of thinking, what on earth is going on here? But I stuck with it and I found it tedious doing the daily meditations and I was, oh, this is just boring. But actually, after about 4 weeks of doing it, I started to look forward to the meditations. And I don't always make time to do that every day, but I've found one of the things we got very good at was acceptance. And by accepting what you've got and not constantly fighting it and try to change it, suddenly you've got energy left to actually live with it. And the pain hasn't got better. The pain is still there, but somehow mentally I just deal with it so much better. So even though I'm not doing daily meditations, I still, the principles of mindfulness, the kind of self-care being the primary thing, all of those sorts of skills have really taken me forward in a better way than anything I've ever done before. I've gone through hours of cognitive behavioral therapy and, you know, all sorts of stuff, and they've never really helped, but mindfulness did. And, you know, whenever anything's a buzzword, it's the cure-all for everything at the moment. And, you know, coloring books have got mindfulness written on it, and there's all sorts of stuff that just isn't actually mindfulness. And if you just let the preconceptions go, and for me, I actually found that once I stuck with it and did let the preconceptions go, it was a big turnaround point for me and making me realize that I can still do all these things, even if I am disabled some days more than others, and just accepting that, yeah, some days I have to just stay in bed. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Just find something to do that keeps you active. It's okay. Don't feel guilty about the fact that you're in bed for a day. If you need to go and lie down for an hour, that's okay, because you can't pour from an empty vessel is the overriding thing that I took from mindfulness. And I know I still don't always look after myself when I push too hard, and I am getting better at it than I was. And I think that that was the thing that did it for me. And I know that that won't work for everybody, but in the end, I had to leave the pain forum because I was giving so much of myself to others that I had nothing left for me. And it was starting to make me feel very down. I was bringing everybody's problems home with me after I'd logged off the computer. I couldn't sleep, so I was worrying about this person. And so it was good when I started, but then I had to kind of move away from that and step away slightly from surrounding myself with other people in pain. I now have a small number of very good friends who have been through similar physical issues. We message each other regularly, check in how each other are doing. I've met through mindfulness somebody else that has non-epileptic seizures. It's the only person I know that suffers with it. That's been great. So having people that understand nearby is good, but also just looking after yourself is the thing that's really helped. So, you know, hopefully that will help other people if they're thinking about mindfulness, because I certainly found it a really big benefit. I've done 2 mindfulness courses now and they were very similar in structure, but I gained a lot from both.
What I find very interesting when you talk about sort of your main strategies is this combination that might sound contradictory, you know, on the one hand saying you have to take good care of yourself, and on the other hand saying, well, I try to get as much as possible out of life and not waste a single moment. I guess it might sound contradictory, but, you know, being in a situation like this, I guess, brings you to a point where it's within yourself. It might be quite logical and quite sort of suiting.
I do push too hard still, and it drives my husband insane, because, you know, he knows what's going to happen the following day or in the days to come. He knows I'm going to end up having seizures and fainting and whatever. And he can see that I'm getting tired and I'm not listening, and I'm still, I've just got to write this, I've just got to do that, I've just got to do this other thing. And he's like, go to bed. So he gets very frustrated with me. And certainly in the previous few years, I kind of got a little bit of extra energy and then just wiped myself out completely and spent a lot of time with facial injuries because of seizures and whatever. I'm getting better. The balance is definitely getting better, and I have had to cut down how many talks I do. I love it so much. I would do it every day given a chance, but I just physically can't. So I'm learning to say no. I'm learning to, I mean, I've had to start taking bookings into 2022 because I'm already getting so fully booked to, I mean, I've got loads of spare time in my diary, but I just can't say yes to things. So it is a bit frustrating, but you know, when I just, one thing that my husband always reminds me of is I quite often feel that I'm not doing a good job of all the things that I do, or that I'm in some way a failure because I haven't done 10 talks instead of two. But he just says, well, look at what you was doing 5 years ago compared to what you're doing now, and just actually be proud of what you're actually achieving. And I don't do that often enough. And I think that's important. So yeah, I might have to say no to a lot of things, but 5 years ago I was doing zero talks. So doing two a month even is good. And if that's inspiring other female speakers to have a go, then it's worth it. So so I am getting a bit better at the balance thing. You know, it's always it just, you know, life is like that. Life isn't it. You can't plan and pace everything. There are things that come up short notice that you just have to say yes to, or, you know, there are always things that are going to happen, and you just have to try and give yourself a bit of breathing space. And I find that even if I just go upstairs and lie down on the memory foam for just 5 minutes in my day, it will give me a bit of a relief from the pain, and I can keep going again. And it's taking that 5 minutes where you think you don't have time, but actually 5 minutes, lie down, do a short meditation, and you come out of it feeling refreshed and raring to go again. So I think it's having the confidence to say, yes, I do have time to have a break here, and just give yourself the space that you need if you need it. So yeah, I hopefully will find the right balance at some point, but I know the stubbornness is always there going, don't let this beat you. But
well, I can relate so much to this thing of finding a better balance, you know. And I've only learned it I guess over the last year to do this, because I also had a spine surgery. Nothing as you know, serious as you have, but still I have better days and worse days, and I had bad periods where I was quite worried about how things would progress. And about a year ago I started to take breaks, to take real breaks, and to allow myself to lie down in between and to have a rest, be it 5 minutes or an hour or so. And I'm so much better now.
It's so amazing what 5 minutes can do. It makes a big difference.
It actually does. And you know, finding ways of how still to make use of this time. So I do a lot of work now simply lying down, you know, sometimes on my carpet, sometimes on my bed. I do a lot of social media research and, you know, work for Mood Maharaj. And it's perfectly all right, and on the whole I'm so much better. So I
could do with one of those kind of contraptions that hold something above your head, so when you're lying flat you can read a computer screen or a tablet, because I normally hold my phone up like this and I keep dropping it onto my face, and
this has happened to me. So there's one point that you've mentioned already, that you sort of found an activity, a different kind of activity, of crafting activity for sort of every posture that you take. And it's also something that you've mentioned as a side note, but I guess it's another kind of rabbit hole. So let's talk a bit more about, you know, the arts that you do, and the crafts that you, I guess, very good at, and what you've made of it. Can you talk about that a little?
Some things I'm not quite so good at, but I love learning new techniques. And actually, I did an art GCSE when I was doing my A-levels. I didn't have enough room to do art at GCSE when I was at school, because I wanted to do the sciences and knew I wanted a career in science. So that kind of was more important. But I always enjoyed art. I did the art GCSE and really enjoyed it. And I carried on having art lessons throughout the 90s. And that was something else that kind of went on a back burner for a long time. And when I was at my worst physically, when you're physically disabled and you've lost a lot of things in your life because of it, and I went through so many losses, you do end up suffering with depression and anxiety. And I realized I hadn't left the house myself in 4 years by myself. And I found out that Sure Trust were running these artworks programs in my local area. So one day a week, I would get on my scooter, go down the end of the road, and we would learn different art techniques that you probably wouldn't have done otherwise. But that was great. I learned so many new skills, but also it got me back out of the house again by myself, meeting with people, because I just became frightened of people. I was frightened of getting hurt. I was frightened of getting stranded somewhere, not being able to get home. So all this fear just started to go, and I was actually involved with so many different things. I was doing work, voluntary work with them in schools. In a school for children with disabilities, we did a kind of 3-month project all around Chinese New Year. So it got me doing all of these things and made me realize actually I still have something to give. And I carried on doing that for 4 years, and I learned so many new things. And that was the start of me kind of just reteaching myself to do the knitting and crochet stuff, but also just having the confidence to get a canvas and some paints and just have a go at doing some art again. And I've always enjoyed looking at other people's astronomy sketches, and I decided to bring those two passions together. And sometimes when you do astrophotography, you can get so obsessed with getting a good picture that you don't actually look at the object. And the whole point of astronomy is to observe. And I hadn't looked in a telescope eyepiece for a year. So I made myself occasionally now leave my camera inside, and I take my sketch pad outside, and I just start drawing what I'm seeing. And that evolved into drawing from photographs. And actually the canvas behind me is a canvas print of one of my pastel sketches of the moon.
Wow.
This was a prize. I used the Liverpool telescope, the Liverpool 2-meter telescope, to take a photograph of this crater trio, and I made a sketch from the photograph, and it won a competition last January. So I actually won this canvas printed, which seeing it that big made me think, right, my sketches need to get bigger as well, because he can just capture so much detail when you draw big. So I now do pastels quite often on black paper. So I sometimes draw at the eyepiece, sometimes from sketches, sometimes just basic pen and paper. So I kind of do a lot of the astronomy sketching. But as well as that, I've branched out into jewellery making. I make things like, I'm wearing a pendant here that looks like the Eye of Sauron. I hand paint these glass pendants to look like eyes. I'm trying to think of all the different things I make. I've just started doing acrylic pouring, which is really therapeutic. You never quite know what result you're going to get, which for someone that's a control freak is actually quite liberating, because when you do an astronomy sketch, you're trying to recreate something exactly. Every little pen stroke has to be perfect. You do acrylic pouring, you dump the paint on and spin it around, you've no idea what's going to come out. So it's quite exciting and quite liberating to do. I also I make stuff out. I like to make things from recycled things. So I recycle guitar strings and bass strings and turn those into jewellery. Old clothes I turn into lavender bags using lavender from the garden. I'm trying to make sort of sustainable gifts. So I was this year, everybody I know pretty much got a crocheted face cloth. So to try and encourage people to stop using disposable cleansing wipes and using these crocheted cotton face scrubbies and face cloths. So yeah, all of those things are things that I can do in various levels of resting. So the crochet stuff I can do laid down, some knitting I can do propped up, a little bit of the painting I can do propped up. There's just whatever mood I'm in, I've got many different things on the go. And just last week, actually, because I love biology still and I love microscopy, I have 2 microscopes, and I was obsessed with finding tardigrades in the garden, because from an astrobiology point of view, tardigrades are really important because they're such extremophiles. They can live out in the vacuum of space in stasis, and then they come back to Earth and rehydrate and come back to life again. And I just thought, I need a crocheted tardigrade. So last weekend, I just crocheted myself a tardigrade, which was really cool. So just I try to bring all my different interest together into one place. So the music stuff comes with the guitar string jewelry, the astronomy stuff with the sketching, the biology with the crochet, just always cross-linking and try and think of new things to do that are slightly different. So yeah, there are so many half-done projects all over my house. I do a lot of card making and painting, and you know, the house is a tip, you know, there's stuff everywhere, but if we get visitors, it all has to get shoved in a cupboard out of the way.
So, Mary, are there any other things that we've not yet touched upon? Because, you know, talking about these rabbit holes, I have the impression when I talk to you much longer, there will be another at least 5 areas to pop up, which I haven't yet known about.
I love baking. I really enjoy baking, and I think I learn a lot of baking from YouTube, because I find baking from a cookery book really difficult. It's just, some people are visual learners, and I think I'm one of them. And ever since I discovered baking channels on YouTube, it's one of the, I spend far too many hours a day on YouTube watching random assortment of stuff for all my different interests. But finding baking channels is just amazing, because you get these great ideas, ways of presenting things. And I'd done kind of fairy cakes and biscuits and stuff, but I'd never really pushed myself to try proper things. So I made our wedding cake when we got married four years ago. It'll be in October. I actually made a astronomy themed wedding cake, and I'd never done anything like that before. And I just thought, I'm just going to have a go. Why not? And I realized why it's worth paying £100 to get someone to make you a cake, because it's really hard work and it's really heavy. And but it was great because I made it, and you know, I will always have the fact that I made it. I made my own wedding dress as well, mostly. I really like sewing. I'm not very good at it, but I like sewing as well. So sewing and baking are kind of two other things that I dabble in that I'm certainly not an expert in, but
so from what you say, I would say one of the main suggestions to people would be to try things and to do what you love, whether you're good at it or not, and whether you're perfect at it or not. Just do it and put yourself out there.
Yeah, I mean, just practice yourself, and you feel like an idiot when I know when I was kind of getting ready to perform with the band, mm-hmm. I will have everything set up at home, and I practice smiling to the audience and clapping the bits where I'm not playing to get the audience, because if you do that for the first time at the gig, you're going to feel awkward and a bit weird. And I felt like a complete idiot, stood in the dining room by myself going, come on, clap your hands. And you just kind of, but when you do it at the gig, it just feels natural to you. So practice baking, practice making buttercream and piping it. And if it looks terrible, nobody ever needs to see it. It's fine. Just use that time by yourself to practice and perfect it. And I never, ever do a talk without practicing it first to an empty room. I feel really awkward practicing it just to my husband, but he's a great sounding board because he's so intelligent and he knows where my strengths are and he has really good suggestions. But for a first time through, I practice my talk with all the jokes, any funny things like that, completely alien on my own in an empty room. Mm-hmm. And that makes it feel more comfortable when you do it for real. And I think that's important, that you feel comfortable doing it. It's good to push yourself outside your comfort zone, but not to the point where you want to be sick, which is what I was doing when I first started doing gigs. And I now know how not to put myself quite that much terror. So yeah, I think just find different ways of learning as well. If there's something you like, but you're struggling to learn it from a textbook, it's like even physics from a textbook can be daunting, but you watch Richard Feynman lectures on YouTube and it all clicks into place. He had such a good way of explaining things, and having a good teacher on YouTube is just as good as going to an actual lecture, and you will learn it better than if you're just reading it from a book, if that's the way you prefer to learn. And I think there is nothing that isn't on YouTube nowadays that you want to learn about. I mean, it's why if I can't sleep, I end up finding out about the mating habits of a native African rhino, because you just don't know where you're going to go when you end up on the YouTube suggested thing. But YouTube's great, because I just find visual learning better than looking at stuff that's written down in front of me. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, just anybody that's interested in anything in life, whatever it is, just push yourself and just try and find different ways of learning it if you're finding it difficult. And just follow your heart. Don't let anyone tell you can't do something because you're a girl, because that's just rubbish. Just if you've got it in here, whether it be baking, cooking, makeup, physics, astronomy, if it's in your heart, then follow it as a career, because you'll never have a day at work if you're doing what your passion is.
I think that's just a wonderful piece of advice. I would like to move on to asking you like the standard questions for Mutmacherei. The first one being, what do you need courage for? And I guess you've already given us some examples where you needed courage, like, you know, playing with a band and going on a stage for the first time. But, you know, when I just confront you with this question, what would be like your general answer? What else do you need courage for?
For me personally, I think I used to be a very confident teenager, and I used to dance, I used to perform in dance shows and stuff. That was all fine. But the minute I kind of had a disability and lost my career and all those other things, it really hits your self-esteem. And I ended up suffering with horrendous anxiety and anxiety attacks, and I had no confidence in anything. And this is something I do, might be a surprise to people, because when I speak in public, I might come across as being very confident, but actually I'm quite shy and I don't have a great deal of self-esteem, and I still don't think anything that I do is good enough. And I have to really push quite hard to find the confidence to do any of this stuff. But 5 years ago, I was scared to even go to the village shop unattended because my anxiety was so bad. So I think I'm not quite sure how I got from there to doing public speaking and live web streaming, but it happened somewhere. But I still feel the nerves before absolutely every single thing that I do. And I do still feel nervous about everything. Every time I submit an article, I think, oh, they're going to send it back and think it's rubbish. Every time I write a new talk, oh, is it good enough? Has it got enough information in it? Is it too long? Is it too short? You know, the usual kind of self-doubt. So for me, I need courage for everything that I do, to kind of put yourself out there, particularly in the internet age, I think, because people will dive on you so quickly if they don't agree with something, or you get one tiny thing wrong. I think you'll find that, and the keyboard warriors are off and at you. So I think you've got to learn to have a thick skin if you are going to put anything out on YouTube. I know I have a YouTube based channel. I know that I'm not the best bass player in the world. Can't even say best bass player, let alone be it. So, you know, I'm completely expecting people to just stamp on me and say, well, that was rubbish. No one has, but I'm mentally prepared that it will happen one time. I know it will. And just be okay with that, because people are more likely to say something negative than something positive. So having no comments is definitely a positive sign.
Well, I guess just by what you've just said, you know, that someone with all your talent and everything you do needs courage for nearly everything will be encouraging to a lot of people, because we don't expect it. We think people who can do a lot of things, they are sort of confident by nature, and it's sort of given to them. So when you need courage for nearly everything, what gives you the courage that allows you to do things?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think actually meeting my husband was a big turning point, because he met me when I was at my most disabled, when I was at my most infirm, and he was able to see past that and saw that me was still hiding in there somewhere. And he really gave me the confidence. He was a kind of mental health support worker. He was an emotional support dog. He was a physical carer, helping me shower. He was all of the things, but without passing judgment, and so open and so warm and so encouraging. And when I did my very first talk, it was to our history society in our village, and I used to public speak all the time in my job. I was petrified, and he sat in the audience and the front row, and every time I looked at him, he was smiling and, you're doing well, keep going. And that was like, oh good. And for the first few talks, I had to have him there, because I'm like, well, I can't do it unless he's there. And you know, once I start get repeat bookings and people want you to come back again, that kind of makes you think, okay, I did something right, I can do this. And now I have an internal dialogue. I do some mindfulness breathing before each thing to just ground myself, because the anxiety can make you shallow breathe without you realizing it, and you can get up and suddenly feel really dizzy. So I make myself do the mindfulness breathing, just kind of, you know, and if I'm feeling if I'm out and about, because my husband will tell you, I have got no sense of direction. I get lost going out to the car, honestly. And the number of times I lose my car or I'm just lost somewhere and I'll be in a complete flap in tears, I phone him and within 30 seconds, he's grounded me again. And I think I just know that if I'm spiraling anywhere, anytime, day or night, I will call him and I'll be okay. And just knowing that he's there, I don't even need to call him. So I think, you know, he has just been amazing. Just he has been the driving force behind everything that I do. And I know that I wouldn't have done any of this if I hadn't met him. So I'm so grateful that I was lucky enough to meet somebody and get married a second time round and actually find my soulmate who makes me do better than I ever thought I could. And he every day encourages me to do more. So I think having that, it doesn't have to be a husband, it can be a friend, it could be a parent, you know. My mum has always been amazing as well, I have to say. She's always so encouraging and so proud, and my parents are really great. They love all the things I do, but Mark is the one that's there day to day when I'm having a wobble and think, oh no, today I'm just not feeling okay to even leave the house by myself. And he'll think, no, you're okay, you can do this. So it's been amazing.
Oh, Mary, that's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. And you know, what really touches me now is how incredibly much of this, you know, this courage that that you sort of receive from your husband, you pass on to the world. Yeah? Because to me, you're such an inspiration. I could easily imagine that this is the case for so many people. Yeah? With everything you do, and with the positivity that you have, and this attitude of always, you know, just do it and just put yourself out there. It's incredibly inspiring. So,
I think I've learned as well. If you do get something wrong, it's not the end of the world. They used to have this fear that, oh, if I play one note wrong in a song, everyone in the audience will point and laugh at you. No one even hears the bass. They do. They're dancing to it. They just don't realize it. Most people do not really know what a bass player is doing. So it's great being in the background and just having fun, because it doesn't matter if you get it wrong. If you stumble over a few words in a talk, just take a moment, pause, just get your teeth back in and just keep going. Nobody's going to hold it against you, because 90% of the audience couldn't get up and do it. So I think it's okay to get it wrong. If you do a talk and it isn't perfect, it's still okay. There's been many times I've done talks that weren't perfect because I've been too sore or too tired. I still get a repeat booking from these people. So it's okay. It's okay to not get it 100% right every time. And you know, that's important for people to understand as well. It doesn't have to be, if you see stuff on telly, it's all been edited together and it looks flawless, and it life isn't like that. You stumble over your words, you yawn, you hiccup, you cough, you need to have a drink of water, whatever. It's fine, just keep going. Smile through it and keep going.
Yeah, and my experience is that people actually love it, because it makes you more human and more sort of tangible and relatable. Yeah? And I've often experienced that, for instance, when I forgot what I wanted to say, yeah, and where was I? You know? Yeah. I was so happy to you know, help you out and say, well, this is the last sentence you said. Or, you know, when I crack a joke about these things, they are grateful for an opportunity to laugh. So I guess it's definitely a good thing.
It makes you human, like you say. And I think my husband always says one of the things people like about me as a speaker is that I'm approachable. Because, you know, I'll just go and sit in the audience and chat to people. I'm not the speaker and I'm going to sit over here by myself. I love astronomy. I love astronomers. I want to hear what people are doing, where their interests are. I just talk to anybody. And it's, you know, it's really, I don't think people always have that experience with the speaker. And I find that weird. I'm just somebody that's there to give a talk, but I'm still a friendly, approachable person, and people email me afterwards for advice, and I always help. You know, people know that they can do that. Anybody that's ever been to one of my talks or a practical session, they know that they can always contact me afterwards. I'm not somebody that puts themselves out there and then hides behind an email address that never gets answered. I actually always reply and help if I can. If I can't, I'll put them on someone else who can. And I find it amazing that not everybody does that. I find it extraordinary.
Well, so it's even better to have role models like you are who put this out into the world and show others that this is a way to do it, and that it's a much nicer and better way to do it.
Yeah, so. I really hate prima donnaism. I just can't, I don't like arrogance. As a trait, I find arrogance is one of the things I dislike the most in people. So I just hope I never, ever develop any signs of that, because I really find it a horrible trait, and that's just not something I hope I will ever have. But
I can't imagine it will ever happen.
Well, when everyone tries to put me on a pedestal and says you're so good at everything, I just say, ask my husband how often I got lost last year, and he'll tell you I'm not good at everything. I can find my way around a night sky, but I can't find my way around on terrestrial earth at all. So
have you ever had to ask the police for help to find your car?
Nearly. I was on a multi-story car park that had just two levels, and there's only space for about 50 cars on each level. 20 minutes I walked around in circles on that top level, and I couldn't find my car. And you know, by this time my back was gone. I had a trolley full of heavy shopping, and I was like, someone's stolen my car, I'm gonna have to call the police. And I remember I've got a metallic gold 20-year-old Rover. Nobody is going to have stolen it out of all of the cars on that car park, and if they did, they'd bring it back within a week, because there are so many things that are wrong with it that they would be kind of like, oh my goodness, how can you drive this? So but my husband said he's going to put a tracker on my phone so he can watch me walk around in circles for fun.
Well, anyway, Mary, it was such a pleasure to talk to you. So thank you very much for being my guest today. It was an incredible inspiration, I guess not only for me, but most probably for a lot of people. So all the best to you. I'm sure we'll stay in touch and talk soon. And thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And so if anyone does want to contact me about any of the issues that we've talked about, then, you know, my contact details will be in the notes.
Definitely. All your information will be in the show notes. Okay.
So. Thank you.
Bye, Mary. Thank you.